Sorry, but I'm just going to get my hands. So basically, my question comes to this issue of movements. And a lot of us on the left decry the lack of a social movement, except there appears to be a very vibrant grassroots social movement on the right in the form of religious fundamentalism. And it seems to have a lot of political influence and power. And so I'm just wondering what your take is on that as a real political obstacle in this country at this point, especially facing Obama.
Well, if you count noses, there's a huge number of activists. In fact, I think more than in the 60s. But it's a very atomized society. Like, take the people here. Many people are involved in activism in this area, but you probably don't know about what other people are doing. I found out over and over again, and let alone what they're doing in other cities. So the big problem here, I think, is not numbers of people who are interested, or the nature of the work they're doing, which is often great, but at bringing people together on a substantial scale. Now, the right wing, you're right, the religious right, the fundamentalist right, has been able to turn itself into a political force. And a large part of the reason for that is something that party managers realized during the Carter years. If you think back over American history, political history too, it's always been, the country's been off the spectrum in religious fundamentalism, way off the spectrum of comparable societies. And there are regular periods of religious revivalism and so on and so forth. But it was never much of a political issue. And so nobody asked, for example, whether Nixon went to church every Sunday, or Johnson prayed, or something like that. It was there, but it was not a political issue. The Carter administration changed that. Carter, I'm sure, was quite sincere about it, but he presented himself as a born-again Christian. And I think that lit a spark in the minds of the PR specialists who run elections. They realized that if the candidate we're selling presents him or her, in those days, himself as a religious extremist, we're going to pick up maybe a third of the vote. Okay? And in fact, if you check, ever since 1980, every candidate has presented themselves as what's called people of faith. That's the euphemism for religious extremists. Many of them are probably about as religious as I am, say Bill Clinton, but it didn't matter. You had to have a picture of him, praying lustfully in the church every Sunday morning or so. So yes, it did succeed in developing a constituency which was organized from the top to turn into a political constituency that could be exploited. I wouldn't want, I don't think any of us would want the left activist constituencies to be of that type. We'd like them to be, the type that we see, for example, in Bolivia, or kind of activism that, the New Deal and so on, which you might have recognized. But it's a problem here. It is an extremely atomized society in which essentially business, propaganda, and domination has succeeded in separating people from one another by all kinds of means, like driving consumerism, say, which drives people into debt, which traps you. If you accept that, you get trapped and you can't become organized. So it's a big job for organizing people, but there's plenty of a tinder out there that can be lighted. I'm sorry, I took a while. A bunch of questions in Greek.
No.
No? Oh, okay. Well, I can get rid of the paper.
Thank you for being here. There are now a substantial amount of people that are calling for a new investigation into the attacks of 9/11, not in order to start a new war, but to find the people that are accountable for the tremendous lapse in our security.
The tremendous
lapse in the security that...
Oh.
Did they just cut my mic? No. the planes not being escorted out of the air and so on and so forth, I'm sure you're well aware of all the inaccuracies. Will you please, you're a leader in public opinion, and in the vein that Rosa Parks refuses to sit in the back of the bus, will you please join us in the front of the bus in the quest for a new investigation?
No, not a long time ago. I mean, years ago, I said, yeah, it'd be a good idea to have an investigation. I don't think they're going to find much, frankly, but I think it would be a very good idea to have an investigation, so I agree with you. Incidentally, these security lapses are constant. So, for example, about a year ago, you'll recall that a nuclear-armed bomber with the bomb's arm flew across the country. And it's an incredible lapse of security. I mean, it's supposed to have been a terrible accident. Could have killed maybe hundreds of thousands of people. It's the tightest security you can imagine governing such things. But that collapsed. Because it happens all the time. In fact, if you look at the intelligence and security record, it's full of incredible lapses. So, you know, the fact that it happened also on 9/11 when the confusion and so on, doesn't seem to be too out of line. But yeah, we should look at it. On the other hand, if anybody thinks they're going to find anything serious, there are questions that really ought to be asked. Like, for example, suppose the Bush administration was somehow involved. Suppose that turns out. Well, I don't think it's very likely, but suppose it does. Then there's a really big question to answer. Why would the Bush administration choose to shoot itself in the foot by attributing 9/11 to Saudi hijackers? I mean, if the goal was to set up the basis for attacking Iraq, which is plausible, then it would have not, you know, lost the goal. They would have picked the Iraqi hijackers instead of undermining what they're trying to do by picking Saudi hijackers and at the same time prejudicing their relations with one of the most valued allies. I mean, you can grant a certain amount of incompetence and stupidity, but that would be good. There are many other questions like this, but in response to your question, I think an investigation would be a good idea. Notice that in the case of the lapse of security with the bomber, it was taken seriously enough so the Secretary of the Air Force and the Air Force Chief were fired.
Go to the format in the interest of time of getting three questions and answering them in clusters, because it's a long line and a short of time.
Yeah. Too long.
Yes, thank you, Professor. I lost my train of thought. Sorry, I had as you sort of touched upon, Obama seems to be filling his positions with recycled members of the Clinton administration. Do you see the Obama administration as being just another Clinton administration, or do you see the administration and the country as well moving to the left of sort of where policy was during the Clinton administration?
My question would be, with reference to the closer to life, with reference to Latin American policy, do you think that Obama shows signs of being conciliatory? After all, it has been claimed that he's willing to sit down. He himself said with Dr. Castro that he'll protect rights of certain activists in Colombia and so forth. So do you think that he will be conciliatory or more of the same?
Professor, you've been a critic of white South Africa in the past. I wonder if the country is any better under black rule, seen as a white race as the spark of civilization. We created the great empires of Rome, Egypt, and every other African continent.
That's three, right? take the first one. Will the country? I mean, my feeling is that the Obama brand, insofar as it's coming from the top, is pretty much a replica of the familiar centrist Clinton style or Democrats. And you can see it from the appointments, and I think you can see it from the statements and the programs insofar as they're realistic. Is it going to happen? Will the country move to the left? Well, we're back to the question of what people like you do. no way to predict that. And take, say, Obama likes to, compares himself to Kennedy. Okay? Did the country move to the left then? Yeah, it did. Not because of Kennedy. Kennedy's record was not very impressive, frankly. He's one of the most dangerous presidents we've had. There's a lot of illusions about him, but if you look at the record, that's what it is. On the other hand, the way people acted in the 1960s was quite different. Lots of people. That's why we became a more civilized society. But you know, that's a choice that people don't have to make. You can't predict it. I mean, if you look back to the 1950s, the standard prediction was we've reached the end of history. It's called the end of ideology. There's nothing to argue about anymore. All the problems have been solved. I mean, you've been an imbecile to keep the economy growing at 3% a year just by pushing the buttons that we already know. And there's no things to debate about anymore. Well, that was the prediction in the 50s. 60s was quite different because people made different choices. And I think that's the answer to the proper question that you raised. What about Latin America? Well, let's say take Bolivia, the most, what is really a remarkable democratic achievement. Now, as always, Bolivia is being punished for the extraordinary achievement of democracy, as you'd expect, just as Haiti was, reflects the distaste for democracy and, on the part of elite elements anywhere across the spectrum. For example, the Bush administration has just removed Bolivia from preferential tariff treatment, probably put tens of thousands of people out of work. The pretext for that is that Bolivia hasn't cooperated on eradication of drugs. Let's put aside the question whether the U.S. had any right to ask, to insist that another country not grow crops that we claim not to like. So, for example, does China have the right to defoliate, to carry out chemical warfare in Kentucky and North Carolina because they grow a crop that's incomparably more lethal than COVID? Do they have that right? No, I don't think so. But put that aside. What's the record of Bolivia? Well, the record of Bolivia is that there was a slight increase, about 5%, in coca production. In contrast, Colombia, which is our major ally, which is pouring in military aid, it was 26% increase. So that can't be the pretext. What's going on is just what I said. It was an extraordinary achievement of democracy that people have to be punished. And in fact, as I'm sure you know, there's a secession, kind of a quasi-secessionist movement. The traditional elites always ran the country, Europeanized, mostly white elites in the eastern zones. They despise democracy, naturally, and they're trying to undermine it, calling for what amounts to secession. And guess who's supporting them? The U.S. government. Big surprise. Not the Latin American governments. And that's interesting, too. There was a referendum a couple of months ago in which Morales won an even bigger percentage in the election. And right after that, the Eastern Zone autonomists organized pretty violent actions against it. A lot of peasants were killed. There was a meeting of the South American Republics. There's a new organization, Union of South American Republics. They had a meeting in Chile, September 15th, in which this includes all of them, even Colombia, in which they issued a strong statement supporting Morales, condemning the opposition. It was read by Michelle Bachelet, who's president of Chile, is one of the prime minister of Chile, is one of our favorites, supposedly. Strong statement of support. Morales responded with an important comment. He said, "This is the first time in 500 years that Latin American countries are taking our fate into our own hands without the intervention of foreign powers, mainly the U.S. That's important. In fact, so important that it wouldn't be reported in the United States. Data research, no mention of it, leak mention. Yeah, that's the reaction that takes place when there's an achievement of democracy. Or getting back to Obama, has he said anything about it? If so, I haven't heard it. Maybe you can find Cuba. Okay. Well, there was a vote in the United Nations a couple of weeks ago on the U.S. embargo, and it was the usual result. It was numbered 183-3. The vote, of course, was to end the embargo, illegal. The three were the United States, Israel, which reflexively votes with the United States, and Palau. Okay. So that's great. Did Obama say anything about it? Ms. Elliott, it wasn't the only vote. There was also a vote on the on trade in arms. Should be allowed to sell arms freely. The vote on that, there were two objections, two opponents, the United States and Zimbabwe. So we were a good company on that one. And a series of similar votes. Well, I haven't heard anything from, about any of these things from Obama. So maybe there'll be a change, but I don't see any indication of it. What about the white South Africa? Are people better off under after apartheid than before? Well, you know, I think apartheid was ending apartheid was a spectacular achievement. That is a historic achievement. Is the mass population better off? Probably not, because it was not the class issue was not addressed, only the race issue, and the huge class issue. So if you count, poverty, death rate, and stuff like that, you could say it's worse off, but you know, that's not the way the population itself, the black majority sees it in South Africa, and they're right. They did succeed in overcoming a tremendous evil. And that's right.
Hi. Could you explain the recent events in Diyarbakir, Turkey, and why they're important? Thanks.
Hi. Speaking of the global challenges of our time, many experts are predicting that global petroleum production will peak sometime in the near future if it hasn't done so already. And given the many ways that our civilization depends on widely available cheap energy that petroleum provides, some people are talking about the collapse of the global economy, even the collapse of industrial civilization itself. Do you think these outcomes are likely? If not, what do you think, what changes will peak oil bring, and how should we respond? Thank you.
Why do you keep covering up the scientifically proven fact that the 9/11 terrorist attacks were an inside job perpetrated by U.S. imperialists?
Why is Diyarbakir important? Diyarbakir is, I'm sure you know, is effectively the capital of Kurdish southeastern Turkey. And in the some of the major atrocities of the 90s were carried out right there, not just in Diyarbakir, but in the Kurdish areas. This is one of Clinton's many crimes, also a media crime because they covered it up. There was a Turkish counterinsurgency operation which destroyed about 3,500 towns and villages, killed tens of thousands of people, drove out unknown numbers of people, maybe millions by some counts, either out of the country or into invisible slums in Istanbul and so on. That's a major atrocity. It was overwhelmingly supported by the United States, about 80% of the arms. In fact, in a single year, in 1997, Clinton sent more arms to Turkey, right at the peak of the atrocity, than in the entire Cold War period combined to the onset of the counterinsurgency campaign. That's major. That's why you don't read about it. It's a major crime for which we were responsible, so you know, not the right story, but it happened. Well, in the early part of this decade, things were improving somewhat in southeastern Turkey, and they're better than they were, but unfortunately, hostilities and repression and atrocities are picking up again, so it's not as good as it was 5 years ago. Yeah, that's why it's important. That's important in itself. As multiply important for us because of our decisive role. As for peak oil, it's considered to be like a catastrophe. It's sooner or later there'll be a peak oil period and a finite resource. Well, the question is, at what point does accessing fossil fuels become too expensive, or maybe too energy intensive for the benefit of using it? And obviously that day will come. Is it a good thing or a bad thing if it's soon? Well, in many ways it's a good thing. So we ought to hope that it's not too far off, because the use of fossil fuels may doom the human species, maybe in a not too distant future. So if it turns out that it's not too far off, we'll be cheering, because that'll drive the measures that should be taken in any event, no matter when peak oil is, to overcome, at least mitigate, maybe overcome, what could be not only a major crisis, but a real crisis of species destruction. It would be, first of all, conservation, which is the first step, which is probably economically efficient as far from anything else. And secondly, an intensive effort to develop a system of sustainable energy, which doesn't just mean some new technical fix, but also changes in the way we live. Lots of them. It's a big topic, but not too much to talk about here. Third question, why don't I accept the scientific proof about the Bush administration involvement in 9/11? Well, that's easy. There isn't any. There are claims claim is that Building 7 had a planned collapse and so on and so forth. Okay, I don't have the technical expertise to judge that, so I just wait. I treat it the same way I do when people make any other claim. Say about intelligent design. Can bacteria evolve? Well, you read the scientists who work on it, goes into material that I don't know enough to judge about, and I'm not interested enough to explore it. What you wait is for them to submit papers to the standard scientific journals and so on, and see what kind of responses there are and what kind of interchanges there are and so on. Well, that hasn't happened in this case, so it's impossible to deal with. But suppose it were true. Suppose it turns out that Building 7 was in fact destroyed by an internal explosion. Well, who would that point the finger to? Osama bin Laden. He's the only person who had anything to gain by blaming it on Saudi hijackers. Saudi Arabia is one of his main enemies. The Bush administration had nothing to gain by that. So we're back to where we were. First of all, no scientific evidence.
Yeah, have some questions. Got some questions in the U.S. and Syria.
Okay. Fine.
Thank you. So, Professor, out of respect for the commitment that we made to you, we really promised to get Professor Chomsky out the door in about 5 minutes. So we're going to take one last question, and I'm sorry to everybody waiting in line.
Yeah. For the rest of it, just say, if you'd like to, you can send me an email.
That'd be good. Okay. I feel like this last election, again, I was voting for the lesser of the evils. How can we promote a third or a fourth party candidate when people feel forced to pick between the two?
Actually, in Massachusetts, you could not vote for the lesser of two evils, because it's a safe state. So there were other choices. You pick one. But how can we do it? Exactly the way poor peasants in Haiti and Bolivia did. I mean, it's ridiculous to claim that with our privilege and our freedom, we cannot achieve what miserable peasants and Haitian slums or indigenous people in the hills of Bolivia achieve. Of course we can do it, but it's not going to happen by itself, any more than it happened by itself here. And there are no magic ways, just the ways that have been done in the past.